declare the glory of the bomb, and the firmament showeth his handiwork.
His sound is gone out unto all the lands, and his light unto the end of the world.
He descendeth from the outermost part of heaven, and there is nothing hid from the heat thereof. There is neither speech nor language, yet his voice is heard among them.
Praise him, my strength and my redeemer.
To the bomb and to the holy fallout, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen. Almighty and everlasting bomb, who came down among us to make heaven under earth, lighten our darkness. O instrument of God, grant us thy peace.
Almighty God, who destroyed all devils and created angels, behold his glory.
Behold the truth that abides in us. Reveal that truth unto that Maker.
I reveal my inmost self unto my God.
Unto my God.
Welcome to Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi. I'm David Klenk.
I am Krampus. That's my very white voice, David. You like that? I am Krampus.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really am. I thought you would just appreciate that. Considering this is as close as we'll get to a Christmas holiday show for this year, I just wanted to throw in a little Krampus because we could all use a little Krampus. I hope you've been a good boy this year, David.
Yeah, and I've seen a doctor, and they're trying to help me with my Krampus. So,
yeah, that's right. Hydration is the most important thing. Drink lots of water. I am Troy Harkin. That full disclosure. And Dave, do you mind if I begin the show with a Beatleism?
Oh, for sure. Go right ahead.
So as we're getting into religion and whatnot today, I thought that I would go with the John Lennon quote, God is a concept by which we measure our pain. And I thought that God is also a great concept for a genre fiction and a podcast on that topic today.
And this is, just in case you're wondering, this is our religion episode. We do have a special guest for this episode. Jerome Stewart is joining us. Troy, will you be so kind as to give us a spoiler alert?
Yes, I will, David.
Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert!
Thanks a lot, Troy. And if this episode doesn't cancel us, I'm not sure what will. We are recording this session via Zoom. In the interest of transparency, I had a couple of poems in the anthology Wrestling with Gods, Tesseract 18, which Jerome co-edited. Here's a bit about our guest. Jerome Stewart is a gay writer and artist whose writing has appeared in FNSF, Fantasy, Tor.com, Geist, Strange Horizons, On Spec, and several Tesseract anthologies. In 2020, he was a finalist for the World Fantasy Award in Short Fiction. His work is often found at the intersection of science fiction, fantasy, and faith. As co-editor of the 2015 anthology Wrestling with Gods, Tesseract 18, he asked others to explore that same intersection. Stewart lived for nearly a decade in the Yukon, but now lives, writes, and paints in Dayton, Ohio, as well as working in a cafe bakery. Welcome. Science can destroy religion by ignoring it, as well as by disproving its tenets. That's Arthur C. Clarke from Childhood's End. He also says the greatest tragedy in mankind's entire history may be the hijacking of morality by religion. But he also says any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
It's so, funny that that first quote you have is from Childhood's End, which Clark is so playing with religious tropes there so much. So anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
No worries, Jerome. So I was wondering, Jerome, what was your first speculative genre memory?
So my mom used to gather us in the hallway between our bedrooms, and she would read to us the Chronicles of Narnia. And that was my introduction to the speculative genre. In fact, I think that was the first time I heard of centaurs and satyrs and all this stuff that I wasn't sure, you know, were safe. Or they didn't seem to be in the Bible as much. You know, I grew up in a very religious home. But boy, did I love the Chronicles of Narnia. That was it was very much it's embedded now with a very sense of family. Like our family read it together, or at least my mom and us in the hallway did. And it was just a beautiful time to, you know, have your mother read to you the first speculative fiction novel, you know, out loud to you. Yeah, it's just, it's a wonderful memory.
Yeah, and certainly with C.S. Lewis, and when we're talking about The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, is very strongly ties in with religion.
And I'm sure that's why they read it to us, because it was in some sense sanctioned. But boy, there's a lot of stuff in there that was very natural to get me into a lot of other spec fic. So yeah.
I was wondering what was the first, and it could be the same thing, but what was the first speculative genre thing that you actually fell in love with and why?
Well, I wrote this down too. I had a hard time, but I think it was probably Star Trek that was my first genre love. The first thing I really, really loved. Just became obsessed with as a kid. And that it was, you know, in the early mid 70s when it went into syndication. So it was a time when you could see it every night, and it was much easier to fall in love with than a weekly program. But man, you could just see, it was just so much adventure and fun. And yeah, my dad and I watched a lot of science fiction, or a lot of Star Trek together.
Mm. We could even just do a podcast episode on religion and faith just in classic Trek, because they had a number of episodes that dealt with that.
And I think I'm building a theme of how family influences your choice of loves and reading. So this could be an important thing to know.
Yeah, thanks, Jerome. Now, we would like to get into your all-time genre faves. Here are some rapid-fire questions about your favorite genre things. We were just looking for titles, but if you feel the urge, you can expand a bit. We do wish to get to talking about religion soon. For this season of the TOF podcast, we reduced the number of all-time faves to about 6 categories. We had almost 20 at one point, and we thought that was too much. So anyways, Troy, if you want to take it away...
Sounds good. So, Jerome, what is your favorite genre author, or who is?
Ray Bradbury is just because I caught him early and just read so much of his. But he has a wonderful way of expressing narrative. His narrative is so beautifully and emotionally packed.
Yeah. I was talking to a friend recently who had come across Something Wicked for the first time. And I think that's the novel I've read the most in my life, because I'm just drawn to his prose in that book. And even like the one chapter, which is just something like, on Saturday, nothing happened, you know, and that's the chapter.
Yeah, chapter 31 with nothing else much happened the rest of the night. That's the only chapter I've actually memorized in all the stuff I've read.
I felt like that book specifically, he was so good about not just writing beautiful prose, but his characters were so, you were so empathetic towards his characters who have lost everything for the wish they wanted. And yeah, the school teacher who, you know, I think she becomes young again and she's doesn't know what to do with herself. And it's just, I felt so moved. He moves you with his prose and he moves you specifically in that book with the characters.
Mm. Yep. And for me, when I first read it, it was falling in love with the boys. Because I read it when I was probably about 14. And then I reread it. I've read it all through my life. But at some point I realized I'm now seeing the book and identifying through the father. And they're both wonderful. They're all wonderful, as you said. Anyway, sorry, I didn't mean to hijack there. But now I wanted to ask you about your favorite genre novel. I know you did mention Narnia, but is it the series overall, or is there one book within that, or is it something totally else you want to throw in as your favorite genre novel?
You know, the idea of favorite is really hard because, I mean, there's so many good things coming out that just, you know, you wrap yourself into and you love too. So, I mean, I loved Left Hand of Darkness, Le Guin's Left Hand of Darkness a lot. And I was a big fan. I like Madeline L'Engle's Wrinkle in Time. That series was really important to me as a kid, but still I go back to that series.
How about your favorite genre shorter work?
Anything, the next thing Tor.com publishes. I really enjoyed Tea with the Black Dragon by R.A. McAvoy.
Okay, and let's go on to, oh, sorry, David, did you have something there? No, let's go on to your favorite genre movie.
Pleasantville.
Oh, nice. That's one that we could do an entire show on for sure. And it hasn't come up that often. How about your favorite genre TV show?
Yeah, I'm a big, my comfort TV shows are Star Trek. So I rewatch the series, you know, every few years. I rewatch all of the series. But DS9 is probably my favorite series of that group.
Okay. So the answer to this next question doesn't have to come from your favorite genre TV show, but can you tell us what your favorite individual all-time genre TV episode is? The pressure is on.
This one was a little easier because the DS9 episode called The Visitor still makes me, it still moves me every time I see it. And that's the one where Jake Sisko loses his father in an accident and spends the rest of his life trying to get his father back. But it's told from the point of view of a young woman who comes to visit a very old Jake Sisko to ask why he stopped writing. And I think it hit me on such multiple levels as a writer, you know, whose life may interrupt your writing and stop you from doing what you love, but also when the need in your heart becomes so much bigger than your career or your whatever. I mean, Jake, the actor who played Jake Sisko, and I've forgotten his name, Tony Todd. Oh my gosh. Mm. Tony Todd is amazing in this. And I just cry every time that episode comes on. It just hurts. It hurts so much. And the actors, you know, Jake Sisko's actor, blanking on names.
Think it's Sirik Lofton.
Yeah, Sirik Lofton. Just all the characters play such a wonderful, they do such a great job in that episode. And it was one of the times that DS9 went way beyond the moment, way beyond, you know, being on the space station or being in order. It went, you know, 40, 50 years into the future and was mostly there trying to you know, figure these things out. And it was just, yeah, it's emotionally packed. Another one of those emotionally packed narratives.
Yeah, I appreciate you mentioning that one. That's one of my favorite. It reminds, I know it's not a genre thing, but it strangely reminds me. Let me just move something over here. So I can actually look. I have your images over on another monitor. I prefer to actually stare at you as I talk, even though this is Zoom. But when it comes to The Visitor, it makes me think of the original movie, TV movie that turned into a TV series. It was called The Homecoming, about John Boy, the Waltons, basically. There was a TV movie that launched it, and it has to do with their father who has not come back in time for Christmas. And they're all worried about what's going on. He shows up at the very end, and guess what? There's a gift of some writing material and some stuff for John Boy, because they know that he's a writer. And it is such a powerful... Go ahead.
We forget that The Waltons is about a writer who is writing about his family. I mean, I think a lot of people forget that part, but every time I see it, it really ignites, like, here's a family that loved having a writer in the house and was like helping him know that this was a real career. And and he was also remembering and trying to preserve his family, you know, and his, and what he loved. Yeah.
Yeah. I love the moment where there's this woman that's giving away gifts, and she says, you have to quote from Jesus or from the Bible. And everyone kept using the very short phrase, Jesus wept. And it turns out this girl got this doll, but it was broken. And then she just drops it in the mud or whatever it was. It's just such a little but powerful moment. I know it's not genre, but I think about that. And Visitor, certainly, and Way Beyond the Stars. There's a few times when DS9 really hit it out of the park.
Yeah. Way Beyond the Stars was also another great one, yeah.
On to religion. Troy, can you give us just a bit of background on it and set in context before we discuss it further?
Well, all cultures have gods and myths to explain creation and to answer questions like why we are here, where we go to, and how we should behave. Generally, these beliefs help form our societies and help to maintain order and civility. Well, it turns out that these beliefs stem from a very specific part of the brain. And it turns out that as a species, we have beliefs and we dream and we create art based on things that do not actually exist in the real world, but clearly as a species, we have a need for these behaviors. And clearly, religion has the possibility for a huge downside. So today, David, we are going to be looking into, at this holy season, questions of God and religion as they are reflected in genre.
Thanks a lot, Troy. Jerome, do you have... I know we talked about your early influences and stuff in science fiction, but do you remember how you were sort of first introduced to the idea of religion and occult and what that all sort of entails, but as it relates to science fiction, fantasy, and horror?
Wow. Now, when you put the word occult with it, it's a very, you know, I grew up in the 70s and 80s and especially during the Satanic Panic and knew that Dungeons and Dragons was the devil, and that poor Tom Hanks being involved in that movie, Mazes and Monsters, that just made all of us Christian kids frightened to death of Dungeons and Dragons. And I didn't play it till I was in my 40s. And I was like, what the F did I miss in my life? This amazing game that was perfectly designed for me. And I had been completely... held back from experiencing that. I mean, we started off with the Chronicles of Narnia, and that would be probably what I would reference as the first time the integration of religion into a fantasy novel, you know, happened for me, that whole series. And so that probably trained me for how they go together, which is, or at least at first, you know, that... there's a lot of hope in the Chronicles of Narnia. There's a lot of care and compassion in the Chronicles of Narnia. There's a talking lion, which, dadgummit, why don't we have those? But I think the concepts of the religious concepts that stood with me are this idea of hope and of compassion, of the things that I feel like are the essence of religion that carry well into science fiction and fantasy. Social justice is another one, you know, the idea of caring for the poor, that this is a responsibility and a duty we have to other people.
Yeah, and we certainly covered Dickens before at one of our holiday things, as Troy will remember, and talk about the ghosts and what it means, family and everything else, and what it is to be a social justice kind of person. Troy, do you have some early experiences of religion and science fiction, fantasy, horror?
Well, I will touch on something that I've talked about probably a couple of times in the show, but this is the perfect topic to revisit it. So for me, The Exorcist was so fundamental in so many different ways. I mean, it affected me as a future writer, but as a child, I mean, it messed me up. And I saw somebody post something recently about asking about The Exorcist, and I said, you know, what's the scariest film that you've ever seen? And so I responded with The Exorcist, that it was so scary to me that it fucked me up for 10 years before I even saw it. That's how effective it was, because I was not yet 10 in 1973 when the film came out. And, you know, like I asked my mother about the ads, which I had heard on the radio. And she said very nonchalantly, you know, oh, demonic possession, that's when the devil takes over your soul. And and I was like, what? What? You know, as if she was telling me about jaywalking or something. And my dad, who had always said to me whenever I was concerned about, like, say, Frankenstein or The Mummy or whatever, he would say, it's just a film. You know, it's just a film. Don't worry about it. It's just a story. Yet with The Exorcist, when I went to mass during the year that The Exorcist was a phenomenon in the theaters, we covered it in the homily, and the priest broke down how the church made sure that the film was accurate and authentic. And so rather than having an adult tell me that it's just a film, I had adults saying, no, this is what happens. Just like my mom had said, you know, this is what it is. So years before I saw it, which was finally in high school, I was messed up because there was kids talking about, you know, what stories they had heard, apocryphal stories like, yeah, my brother saw it and he saw the devil at the end of his bed with a sword and it tried to cut off his ankle. And he's got a wound from it. And, you know, just like things like this. So it was like, yeah, this is not Frankenstein. This is not The Mummy. This is like, I'm being told by adults, this is real.
Yeah, so it wasn't fiction.
Yeah. Now, what I want to say is I love both the film and the book. But the book I find beautiful in terms of faith. It is such a wonderful and uplifting book, I think, for a person of faith, because it is about confronting evil and standing up to it and coming together, you know, as a family and a couple of priests, coming together to confront evil. And there are some lines in that that just bring me to tears because they are beautiful affirmations of faith. Anyway, so yeah, I'll probably wrap it up there, because again, we'll end up doing a third part to a two-part Exorcist show that we did.
Yeah, and we'll certainly get into a bit of Stephen King, because a lot of his stuff has some religious overtone too, and also deals with an actual people getting together as a family or as friends to stand together against the demons. So anyways, so we're now into the part where we sort of do a free-for-all where we can talk about it. And one of the things, by the way, Jerome, that both Troy and I watched recently was Children of Men, which I watched it again just a couple days ago in prep for this episode, even though it came out in 2005. And my God, that film still holds up. And it's such a powerful, and the actual fighting and everything that goes on is so real.
I didn't rewatch that, and I've only seen it once. And I don't know. I didn't carry away. It was a powerful film, I remember at the time. But my takeaway now is so much less. I don't know. I mean, it's protect the pregnant woman so that the species can survive. Mm. And yeah, that emphasis on procreation for the essence of society, the essence of humanity. And I know that's an important, procreation is a very important part, but I think as a gay person, we're often told that procreation is the important thing. And if we're not procreating, what are we doing on the planet? And so that can have a different kind of sound to mm-hmm. me at times.
Right.
Mm. No, fair yeah.
Enough. What got me the first time with Children of Men was when it, I don't know how deep into the film we got. I guess it's maybe as soon as you realize that Key is pregnant. That I realized, oh, Clive Owen, he's Joseph, like this is a nativity story. This is,
yeah.
and the cool thing about it is, so often with the nativity story, clearly the emphasis is on both Jesus and Mary, but now we sort of talk about, we're seeing it through Joseph's eyes. We're seeing it through his sacrifice to basically deliver the pregnant woman and the child. And I ended up like crying through that film once that dawned on me that I was watching a nativity story. So now I clearly can't watch it without, and there's that great scene, the one where they're coming out of the firefight of the two sides. And Key has the newborn and it's a tracking shot, a long continuous tracking shot where the soldiers one by one put down their weapons when they realize there's the newborn. And it, cause it feels so real. It's one of those, it's done a lot yeah. now, but it's one of those deals where you get blood splatters on the lens, or probably done in post, but it looks like it's on the lens. And, and all of a sudden that stops as soon as each soldier sees the baby, which I don't think, would actually happen now, but it's just so profound at that point. Anyway. Yeah. Yeah.
Dang it. I should have rewatched that before we got here, because I think seeing it through that lens would have been a lot better. Yeah.
Well, I now include it right us alongside of Die Hard as a Christmas story, as a Christmas film. yeah.
One thing was a Fifth Element, which is quite powerful too, because you have, I think, some a religious order that's actually trying to protect or trying to make sure that the woman in the story is actually safe and is able to fulfill what her destiny is. The idea that the fifth element is, as opposed to fire, air, water, and what have you. Go ahead.
I just rewatched that too, and I was I really loved the fact that that she was not the element, that love was the element, and she was just like those stones. She was a stone that you had to do and interact with. She had to be loved, and you couldn't do that with a stone. So that was a person, and so yeah, I just thought it's a very powerful and fun film. It's campy, but I love that film, and so I would have listed that as my favorite, one of my favorite films to rewatch, because I can rewatch that endlessly
for sure. And now, again, for our listeners, and we have a lot of them who are probably both either atheist or agnostic, but it really, to me, that also encompasses the whole sort of Christian message that, that we, each one of us, can be Christ. Each one of us can be called to be godlike. And to serve in a Christ-like manner. Like, that's the idea. We are the ones that are supposed to be, we don't have to wait for this delivery. We can be the ones who deliver.
Yeah, and I wonder if, you know, we talked before about how religion's message is love, but there's a disconnect a lot in the way it's practiced. And so you get a lot of people turned off by a religious message because they can see that, you know, it's not being lived out, that love is not there, that love is control, and that love is restriction, and or at least the way that it's being interpreted. And Fifth Element and other films, and I think science fiction and fantasy genre in general, wants to take that message and clean it off and say, yeah, no, the essence is good. And this was the essence of it, and we're getting it all wrong. And so I love genre for being able to wrap that love package in a different wrapping so people don't keep seeing how badly we're doing it in real life and see the real message of loving each other as the main drive for religion.
I'm not being trite. There's your Christmas message right there. If you want to take anything away, there you go. Thank you for that, Jerome.
You're welcome.
And I realized with, I've always loved Mila Jovovich's portrayal of Lilu. I watched something else that reminded me of Lilu recently, and that was Kevin Smith's Dogma. And I love Alanis Morissette at the end of the film as God, who doesn't really speak. She kind of just goes I forget the character she goes up to, but just goes boop on the nose. And and Alan Rickman actually plays the voice of God. And he's wonderful on that too. You know, not anybody's best film ever, but some neat messages in that one. And not particularly, I guess, other than the topic, not really genre, not hardcore. It's certainly not sci-fi, but I guess you could maybe put it into a fantasy category, yeah, perhaps.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote a poem about how all the way I was raised by my parents, they shouldn't be surprised I was into fantasy and science fiction, because the Bible as fantasy literature is a real thing. When I look at the Bible, there are so many tropes that we've taken from there, you know, animals speaking, God's walking on earth and caring for people, and pillars of fire, and, yeah, you know, revenge, and just a lot of, tropes that we shouldn't be surprised that religion and fantasy, at least, or kind of go so well together. We're being trained in a bit. The Bible has so much fantasy in it, so much of fantasy elements. I don't want to say fantasy because, you know, I still believe it's true, and true in a larger T true rather than a smaller T. You know, nobody knows if these events actually happened, but the truth in there is really strong.
For sure. Yeah. We get virgin births. We get people returning from the dead.
Yes.
It's sort of all, it's all there.
Jesus as necromancer. I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah. And I once had a conversation with a friend who was then an agnostic, but now is actually born again. He said to me, you know, when I was younger, I was trying to talk to him about the merits of faith. And I said, you know, if nothing else, faith actually, yeah, helps you, you know, to give you a reason to be compassionate, but it also, yeah, in terms of for creative people, because he's an artist, I said, you know, it flexes a muscle. You know, when you're asked to believe in things that are, you know, apparently not believable, you know, you have to flex your imagination. Mm. And when you do that, things become possible. You know, when you accept things that, you know, other people are not believing as being possible, then all of a sudden things get larger. You might do something that was never thought of as being possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or even writing, you know, it helps you with, I found as a writer, yeah, like I can conceive of things that I wouldn't have been able to if I just was always shutting it off and saying, well, that can't happen.
Literally, it's the box that you want to think outside of. you know, the science and the way things have been done. And I do think faith allows you that ability to go, well, what if? And can you believe in that so much that you can come up with story or painting or whatever? Yeah.
That's a great quote. The box you want to think outside of. Thank you for that.
one of the things that we've talked, and for some reason it didn't make my list of films that have sort of a faith or religious connection to it. And we did a lot of prep, Troy and I, and we had all these things. And suddenly I realized just a few minutes ago, Field of Dreams.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Seven.
Has got so much
or is
faith.
It,
yeah, yeah, because
it, he's exactly. hearing a voice. He's hearing a voice from somewhere, yeah.
Exactly. And he says, you know, is this heaven? No, but it's Iowa or something. And you've got the idea that the older guy, Timothy Busfield, who, or not super older, but he's someone who just doesn't believe it. But when he actually sees, you know, what are these baseball players doing there? You know, he finally makes that leap. He finally connects and is actually able to see as a child. That just is more of an emotional moment now that I'm thinking about it.
It is very much a faith oriented movie. I don't want to say faith based, but oriented because it's got all the elements. You hear a voice that tells you to build what? An arc? No, a baseball field, you know? And it's the same kind of drive that you just do it, even though it sounds ridiculous. And then it brings out something that you really needed. Like the, you know, what Kevin Costner needs in that film is answered through the baseball field. This moment, I mean, the holy moment of too many movies, I guess, that you have to play catch with your dad or else, you know, you're a warped emotionally, you know, emotionally backed up kid if you haven't played catch. But I do, yeah. I love the film for its persistent belief in following that impulse that you don't know. The mystery is so big. And I think that's something that faith and religion offers us too, is it brings back a little mystery and says, you don't know everything. Your science can't figure out everything. There's something more than what you can figure out today. And I like that. I like the fact that you're following something you don't know, but you feel this impulse to do that.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to mention, you mentioned the messages, is one of them was ease his pain. I think part of what faith and this is helps you deal with grief. I lost my wife in February, and it's been a very rough time. But, you know, in some cases, something like a faith or a belief that she might be in a better place is something that helps us be able to, you know, whether one believes that or not.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's what Field of Dreams brings, is that the idea of the actor James Earl Jones walking into that cornfield. That we'll eventually do a cornfield episode, basically, because cornfields deal with a lot in science fiction, fantasy, and horror. But him just laughing and smiling as he walks into that is just a wonderful moment.
It is. And, you know, every character gets kind of what they wanted. Even the mean, evil brother character, you know, finally finds some happiness, I think, at the end. I think he does. The mystery behind the cornfield that he doesn't, that not all the secrets are revealed in that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, you know, one of the great things that allows for the marriage of religion and spirituality and genre is obviously the existential element and the questions that we ask, like, you know, why is this happening? For me, I was in university, even though I was familiar with the book, I was blown away by the Book of Job in the Old Testament. And so much so that I ended up, my first novel is called The Good Man. And it's basically a modern retelling of the Book of Job, because I realized, you know, if you sort of lose the preamble with the bet between God and Satan and the end with Job being compensated, it's, which is the essence of the story. It is a horror story.
It is.
And I realized if you did this with a character who was both, in my case, he was a theology professor who has a brain tumor. And so, like in The Exorcist, as shit starts to befall him, he isn't sure if it's real or not. Like, is this something that is happening to me, being done to me, include like all of the travails that he has to go through, you know, and he hears voices like in the Field of Dreams, where he's sort of sent on a vision quest to confront the thing that is causing his evil. Anyway, sorry, I didn't mean to do a little promo there, but I think that's the territory that we get into, where it's really easy to marry these religious concepts with our fiction.
Mm. But you can also marry it with science, Jerome. Mm-hmm. Like you had mentioned in when we were prepping for this, the idea of the movie Contact, and of course, based on the novel Contact, how much it is such a wonderful combination of faith and science. Do you want to talk? I mean, you may want to respond to Troy about his thing also.
I do. I mean, I loved what Troy was saying too. I find Job. I want to come back to Contact, but I do find Job so torturous. But I, as an author now, what we do to our characters when we're writing is very similar to what happens to Job. It's like, I mean, you take things away from them until they have nothing and find out what will they do. And did we learn this from Job? That's an awful thing to do to a character, you know?
Wow.
I find that compensation part. Where he had, what, 12 daughters, and he was so much, and they were just as good as the first. I was like, no, they're not. They are not as good as the first ones. No, no.
Yeah.
That's cruel. But I think the essence of what you're talking about is, what do we do when shit happens? How do we cope? And where do we go? And I think faith does allow us not just hope, but it allows us a community of other people whom shit has happened to, who are coping. And it's that community of believers in the sense of community of travelers, put it that way. Community of travelers who are like, yeah, the shit is horrible. And here's my hand, my very real hand, holding on to you. And yes, we'll focus on the hope that we both believe in that is coming from a higher source. And I think that's important. But I also think such a component of faith and religion is the fact that we are the physical manifestations of that faith, that we are supposed to be reaching out our hands in the shit moments to each other and saying, I'm with you. And that is an important part, that you're not alone through your shit.
Yeah, and hopefully they're not like Job's friends and saying to you, you know, what have you done? Have you offended God to do this? Yeah.
have you done? You're a bad luck guy. Yeah.
Do you guys recall the Warner Brothers? Not Warner Brothers. Yeah, I guess Warner Brothers cartoon Duck Amok with Daffy Duck, where I'll describe it again in a second for those who don't know.
Oh wait, is it the one with he gets to the artist erases his foot and
and it turns out that the artist is Bugs Bunny.
So
you just reminded me, you just brought that to mind, that is that what we're doing? Is that also the same thing, what we do to our characters? Are we the god or the Bugs Bunny who is like causing all this pain for Daffy Duck?
I want to come back to Contact in a moment, but I just remembered God Game by Andrew. Oh, I can't think of his last name, but God Game was amazing. It's about a guy who creates like a video game and realizes that his characters can see him and interact with him as if he's God. And he wants them to do certain things in this narrative and enforces them to do them, but with dire consequences, and learns how to be a god that is much better. Like, it's such it's a really beautiful novel. I want to say McNeely or
It says Andrew Greeley.
Andrew Greeley. Oh, yeah.
What does that mean?
God game. Why. Yeah, it's really good because it's us realizing what it's like to be a god and how difficult it would be to get what you want out of your characters, and why God has to be more compassionate to let us find our own ways, even if it's bad, even if it's difficult, because forcing us to do it would not be right, you know? And yeah, I think it's a good book, but I do want to get back to Contact, because I love Contact's message is so interesting. Because for the entire movie, you have a protagonist who is science-based, and it's Jodie Foster. She's doing an amazing job in the film portraying this scientist who is after truth, but the world keeps telling her, well, it has to have a faith component or it's not real truth. And we don't like you as our representative of Earth going to meet the aliens because you don't believe in something. You don't have a faith. And we want to choose somebody else who's more faith-oriented. And what's ironic is that the ending, she becomes the believer and everybody else becomes the skeptic, because she knows what she experienced. And the truth in that last 30 seconds is the erasing of those 8 hours of film, you know, that they just don't want that truth to be known. And it's the irony on top of irony on top of irony right at the end is just bam, bam, bam. You know, it's just a wonderful. You see her become a believer because of her experience, which is kind of how all of us become believers. We don't maybe not become believers because of we've been trained as much as when we have an experience that causes us to go, wait a second, that's not possible, and yet it just happened, and this means a great deal to me. How do I incorporate that into my worldview? What she's doing. Go ahead.
No, I'm actually now, I just feel like a dick for actually having a stupid comment, but I was going to say, if only she had played catch with her dad when she found him.
Dad comment.
Wow.
But Matthew. Yeah. No, but I, yeah. And what's funny is it is her dad that appears to her, Troy, at the end. Remember, it's her dad that she lost.
Yeah.
That comes to her and he's like, I'm not your dad. I'm just I know this is going to be a calming image for you. And he's very, you know, the alien's very upfront, but it is really, in a metaphorical sense, her getting to have closure with her dad that she didn't have at the beginning of the show, or at the beginning of the movie. And I think that's so powerfully put there too, that again, it's someone familiar that is the receptacle of the faith or receptacle of the compassion. The thing that reaches out to you is not some faraway god, it's someone you know, it's someone right beside you, it's someone you love, and it's such a powerful message.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a beautiful film.
It is.
One of the things that I think we may have talked about beyond Contact might be The Matrix from 1999 and Signs from 2002, which both have their connections. And I think Signs is more of one of those films that I think is underrated. Like, people don't quite have it in the same reverence as others. I don't know if you want to talk just briefly about those before we talk about other things.
I do love Signs. Oh my gosh, I love Signs. I think Signs, what's wonderful about, and I'm not sure, I want to say it's M. Night Shyamalan, but I don't know the exact pronunciation of the last name, but I just feel like I got so scared. The way he does horror is so beautifully done. He knows what scares you. He knows that you know that moment where Joaquin Phoenix is looking at the television set. So it's you're looking at Joaquin Phoenix looking at a television set who's looking through a camera at a alleyway in Mexico or in a South American country, and you're waiting, and that alien passes by and the music hits, and you're like, you know, you get scared, but it's such a beautiful film in the sense of you know, the loss of faith at the beginning because of the horrible thing that's happened to the man, to the preacher, and to the priest, and his regaining of faith through that film is very powerful. That, you know, it sets up something Jung called synchronicity, which I think is a lovely gateway into faith. If you want to go the back door through faith, going through Carl Jung's idea of synchronicity escapes all of the trappings of religion and churches and the Pope and all that kind of stuff. The idea of things happening that seem coincidental but end up being for a reason, or you can find a meaning in them. And that film is full of, obviously planned, you know, by the writer, but it's for the priest is, wow, all of these things were just the things that needed to happen in that order for us to save humanity in exactly this way. And the priest is like, how can I not believe? It just comes right back.
Did you want to get into the DS9, Jerome?
Oh, well, I'd love to. I mean, I love talking to you guys about this topic. And I think DS9 does the best at, for me, of a science fiction series dealing with faith and religion. I felt very seen, but also critiqued in a way. I mean, in a good way. I felt like the really good components of faith and religion are allowed to be messy and come out of that series, but also, you know, the dangers of religion as a controlling mechanism, as people who seek power can hold on to that control. It's both, you know, because Sisko ends up becoming the emissary, literally, from, you know, that he's sort of destined to be. And he's brought there kicking and screaming, but he understands it better. And Kira is allowed to be messy and doubt and also believe. And I want to say, what's her name? Kai Nguyen. Oh my gosh, Kai Nguyen is such an amazing character for being a believer who wants to believe so badly in that the prophets are good and real, but they won't speak to her because they know she's a power-hungry person. And she won't accept that. She's like, I can't see my, you need to talk to me or I will destroy you. and I love her for that horribleness that comes from so much pain of being rejected by the abandonment of the supreme being you want to follow so badly that they don't talk to you. And I'm just going to destroy it for everybody. I'm going to destroy them because they didn't like me. And she's very empathetic to me. She's horrible. I hate her too as a character, but she's beautiful in her pain for that, you know, her trajectory. I don't know. I'm rambling on, and I'm not sure if I'm having a good discussion about.
No, that's fine. That's great. And I don't know, Dave, because you're a little more familiar with Deep Space Nine than I am. Did you have any response to any of that, or anything you wanted to add about it?
Yeah, they did make it a very important factor in it, and with Sisko having to be a commander of a station. But also this connection to the wormhole and him being an emissary was a very complicated and very real and problematic at times. And Starfleet didn't even know what the heck to do with it other than perhaps just leave him in there. I mean, he has doubt of faith, too, because he lost his wife during Wolf 359 and had this issue with Picard. And the very open, like that first two-part, that like a number of these series had two-part open, like Encounter Farpoint. Yeah, that first two-part episode was probably the best of all the series openings because it covered everything. At the very end, that scene with him and Picard and him finally saying, yes, I want to be the commander, was quite amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. That, I think you're right. I go back to that first episode of DS9 and I just think it's so well written, because before, Star Trek had often been in this mode of making sure that they unplugged religion along the way. They just kept pulling the plug every time they met a species that was that had faith. They made sure to unplug their faith somehow. And this one, they didn't try. It was such a component of the culture that they were respectful, and it ended up being such an integral part of the whole show. And you're right, David, very problematic at times. How do you be the logical leader making practical choices for the good of, you know, multiple species when you're also the savior of this people that, you know, they see you in such a, they see you can do no wrong, and you're like, no, I'm just a human being. I'm going to make mistakes. And yeah, it's, he's almost being handed the ring of power that Kai Wynn wants, and he won't put it on.
But it's also the aliens at the beginning. They don't understand the fact that we've got finite lifetimes, because they think of the long term, and they don't quite understand the whole grief that he's holding on to, and the fact that we only have a certain amount of time in this existence. So that I think was handled very well as well.
David, that moment when the aliens keep trying to tell Sisko, you keep telling us you live in a linear fashion, but you exist here. And it even tears me up now. It's like he can't leave the moment in time with his wife who is, you know, underneath this wreckage, if he could just get her out. And he's living a non-linear life and didn't know it, you know, as we do with our memories. And I think that's such a powerful moment.
We have a few minutes before we get into wrapping up, and I just wanted to touch a little bit on Battlestar Galactica, especially the reboot of it, which is one of my favorite sci-fi TV series, at least space-based. And I wasn't even aware until the show was kind of winding down that it had these tie-ins with, I guess, Mormonism. Which, again, because,
well, I mean, the first series especially did, and this one even more so. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I wasn't aware of things like, you know, Kobol and Kolob. And even just the, well, now this is not such, I guess, a Mormon concept, but the idea of this has all happened before, that I loved that wrapping up the series with that scene, where it's, you know, presented to us, and then we see the evolution of almost like the singularity of the Cylons being born. If do you guys want to throw in on this at all, on you know, aspects of BSG and religion?
I think I love the fact that the Cylons were monotheistic and the humans were polytheistic. And it was such an interesting twist, because it made, you know, a believer or someone who's dealt with religion before go, wait a second, the bad guys believe in one spiritual being. Why am I with the bad guys? And just the way that I really enjoyed the series on how the Cylons were not, they didn't remain the villains through the entire thing. They just remained an adversary because they believed something different, and they had their own belief in reincarnation and in, you know, all sorts of other things that they had built around their existence. And who's to say they were wrong, you know?
Yeah. Those are great points, Jerome, because, you know, one of the things that, I mean, we get into this not just with religion, but humans always seem to want to fall down the rabbit hole of tribalism. right?
Yeah.
And you're right. Like, that's one of the things that BSG did. It was, you know, it could have been easy to take the Cylons and just always have them as this robotic villain thing, but it literally humanized them.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah. The other thing that I would take also, because very early on, a very powerful message or moment from Adama, when things have gone to hell, basically, and things are not going great, but they've somehow escaped, and he's trying to, and he has that speech about how there is a 13th planet. There is this 13th colony, because there's the 12 colonies all related to the different, you know, aspects of like Scorpio and so on, the astrology. But there is a 13th one. And he gives them what is hope or faith in the fact that we've got this thing to go to and we can all work towards. Otherwise, what are we, if we don't have that goal, if we don't have that faith, if we don't have that belief in going on, what a powerful moment that was.
Yeah. And isn't that something essential about religion in some ways? It offers us meaning and purpose and goal. That's a collective, that could be a collective goal that we could all get behind. I mean, if it wasn't so warped at times, it could be pure, this idea of, you know, aiming towards something. And you're right, that gives the whole, I just rewatched the first episode of Voyager, where Janeway is also pointing towards home, and it gives the series this collective faith that we will get home before 75 years is up. We will get there earlier. We will all be focused on this one thing. And yeah, I love that about BSG. I think that really cemented the series from the beginning with that faith that they were, you know, all trying to get there in one piece.
Well, there's that again, the same speech where it's basically Adama is taking them to church. He is actually doing this as if he is the minister or the priest in front of the congregation. And that whole bit about "so say we all," the actual script had him say "so say we all," but he decided as the actor, he said, just keep the cameras going on me. He walks down among them and he keeps repeating it, which was not in the script. He said, "so say we," and then everyone responded and they kept responding even more each time he said it. Was such a powerful moment, unscripted.
Wow, I had no idea that was unscripted. And that becomes such a big phrase for the whole, you know, that belief that I keep saying that because, you know, I believe, and I believe in the collective goal. Yeah.
Mm. Well, do we have any final, because I think Troy, we're almost at time. I mean, we haven't even gotten into Dune and the Kwisatz Haderach and the Bene Gesserit.
And this means that it necessitates Jerome coming back for sure.
Please. Oh, I would love to, I watched Dune specifically for this, and I think it's such a powerful, another message about, you know, the control that religion can have. And yeah, I just think that's a great thing to explore. Please, let's do this again. That'd be fun.
Oh yeah, I mean, we've got like Planet of the Apes. We've got the whole Star Wars thing. There's a ton of stuff that we have not even scratched the surface on yet.
Yeah, we're sorry we only had one episode based on our season. Because this is definitely a two or three parter, if not many more parts. Because you're right about the Force, and you're right about all of the other things. The beneath the Planet of the Apes, where they're worshiping the bomb and everything else. There's just so many examples that we just can't get into yet. But I think we did very well this episode, I think.
I think we've created sort of the perfect Christmas present for everybody out there. So thank you, Jerome.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun.
So that's our religion episode. Thanks to our special guest, Jerome Stewart.
Thank you, Troy and David. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Jerome. Please, everybody out there, remember to catch us on your favorite podcast provider. Do the old like and subscribe. Remember, well, I mean, you can check us out on Spotify. That's what I do these days. And go to the website, numeric2of.ca, and we're also on Facebook, and you can chat with us there. Throw your 2 cents worth in. That's Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi. It's all words, no numbers on this one. And that's it. We want you guys to have a great holiday season. I hope you've enjoyed this show.
Yep, and everyone just have wonderful holiday season. We are going to be back. I think this one's dropping on December 16th. We'll have a robot show that we're recording on the Tuesday night on the 19th, and then it'll broadcast on the 30th. I think we're taking the month of January off, and we'll be back in February with new episodes. And anyways, I am David Klink.
And I'm Troy Harkin.
See you all for our next episode of Two Old Farts
Talk Sci-Fi.
Tamaso ma dotir gamaya, mithya ma amritang gamaya. With heavy hearts, we lift up their bodies to you, O lords of Kobol, in the knowledge that you will take from them their burdens and give them life eternal. We also pray that you look down upon us now with mercy and with love, just as you did upon our forefathers many years ago, just as you led us from Kobol and found the 12 worlds. So now we hope and pray that you will lead us to a new home where we may begin life anew. So say we all.
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 Are they the lucky ones? That's what you're thinking, isn't it? We're a long way from home. We've jumped way beyond the red line into uncharted space. Limited supplies, limited fuel, no allies, and now, no hope. Maybe it would have been better for us to have died quickly, back on the colonies with our families, instead of dying out here slowly in the emptiness of dark space. Where shall we go? What shall we do? Life here began out there. Those are the first words of the sacred scrolls. And they were told to us by the lords of Kobol many countless centuries ago. And they made it perfectly clear that we are not alone in this universe. Elosha, there is a 13th colony of humankind, is there not?
Yes. The scrolls tell us a 13th tribe left Kobol in the early days. They traveled far and made their home upon a planet called Earth, which circled a distant and unknown star.
It's not unknown. I know where it is. Earth. The most guarded secret we have. The location was only known by the senior commanders of the fleet, and we dared not share it with the public. Not while there was a Cylon threat upon us. For now, we have a refuge to go to. A refuge that the Cylons know nothing about. It won't be an easy journey. It'll be long and arduous. But I promise you one thing. On the memory of those lying here before you, we shall find it. And Earth will become our new home. So say we all.
So say we all.
So say we all.
So say we all.
So say we all. we all!
So say we all!
So say we all.
So say we all.
Dismissed!